your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hoof, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And I sing it loud, and I sing it proud. All that music here in the studio today has gotten me worked up. That's right. Rusty Simpre doing a fine job as interview host. You didn't know you had it in you, did you? It's all that time hanging out, listening to the wake-up call that got him all primed for that kind of stuff. Today is the first Sunday in April of 2009. I was talking with somebody just this week how I had vivid memories of New Year's Eve 1999, wondering if we were going to make it into 2000. And here we are. On the severe downslope of this decade. Oh, goodness gracious, it is flying by. And we're going to help the next hour fly by with a very educational and interesting topic. It's, you know, I was doing my homework for this and realized just how stupid I am at economics. One of the reasons that I backed out of going to McIntyre so many years ago. Professor Herman Schwartz here in the studio today, professor of politics, correct?
Correct.
Correct. Professor of politics at the University of Virginia, author of a new book, Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. That in itself, that's three different topics right there we can talk about during the hour. We'll do a little lay down so that you start from the proper part of the educational pyramid on that, because really it's, with everything that's going on today, I think we all need to understand a little better, and it takes us into areas of conversation that I think a lot of people don't always get to when they talk about how things are hurting their 401k and exactly what got us there. Professor Schwartz wrote the book with Leonard Seabrook. You can find it.
Actually, that's a second book.
That's a second book?
Yeah.
Well, that shows how much my homework was done late last night. So Herman Schwartz, professor of politics at the University of Virginia, Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. There are so many things out there to do. How do you combine these three topics into one book? Am I foolish to think that they're sort of, that the tie between them could have been severed so that you could have written one book on each part of that topic?
You certainly could have written one book on each of those topics, but the interesting thing is precisely the connections between these things. These things are interesting because they didn't used to be connected. So if you go back 30, 40 years and you said, what connection does housing and housing finance have to global markets? The answer would be absolutely zero. Houses are not what we call a traded commodity. Nobody imports or exports them in any real significant numbers. And the money that went into housing, mortgages, also didn't cross borders. People basically borrowed from banks in their local markets, and they made payments back to those banks. So the question was, how did these payments become part of global flows of capital? And the answer to that question has two steps. The first step was that the two huge American government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, solved what was a big problem in American housing finance after the Depression and after World War II. And the big problem was that there were a lot of places in the U.S. that had a lot of money and a lot of places in the U.S. that didn't have a lot of money, and mortgage rates were very low in the first place and very high in the second place. And that was because money would come into local savings banks and get recycled into the local market, and it would never leave that local market. And what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did was what we call securitization. They bought mortgages from those local banks. And by buying mortgages from those local banks, they did three things. The first thing was they gave those banks more money to go out and make more mortgages, which helped the American housing boom in the 50s and 60s. Second thing they did was to level out differences in interest rates across the country, which helped economic growth in places where there wasn't a lot of money, like the American South and the American Southwest and West. They also helped out people who had too much money in places where there was a lot of money, like the American Northeast, who were getting low interest rates for the money they put into savings and loans. So they helped level out interest rates as well, which helped savers in places with money, and it helped borrowers in places without money. And the third thing they did was create an enormous pool of bonds, because they took these mortgages and they packaged them together. This is the security part of securitization, security meaning a bond or a stock. So they created bonds from these mortgages, and they sold these bonds to pension funds, mutual funds. And that was a great deal for these pension funds and these mutual funds also, because those funds had very, very long obligations, 30-year obligations. They were writing life insurance contracts on 30-year-olds, or they were offering pensions to 30-year-olds, 35-year-olds, and they wanted to know that they would have the money to make payouts on those life insurance contracts and those pensions over the next 30 years. And the only way to do that was to hold some kind of asset that yielded income on a 30-year period. And these mortgage-backed securities did exactly that. On the one side, you had somebody who was buying a house. They were committing themselves to 30 years of payments. And on the other side was the pension fund or the mutual fund or the life insurance company, which wanted 30 years of steady payments. And in the middle was Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, who basically brought the two of them together. So that was step one, making bonds that could be sold and held by these pension funds.
Simple question.
Yeah.
Everybody's familiar with the names Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, especially now. You don't even have to be a homeowner or somehow involved very heavily in the economic market. Why do we have two of them?
Why do we have two of them?
Yes.
That's typical American politics.
Don't they do the same thing?
They do almost exactly the same thing. And this is just typical American politics. So Fannie Mae was started back in the Depression. It stands for Federal National Mortgage Association or Federal National Mortgage Agency. And when they started this in the Depression, the idea was to do exactly what I was talking about. And it did it for commercial banks, not for savings and loans. So around about the mid-1960s, savings and loans wanted a piece of this action. And they went and they lobbied Congress to get a similar kind of organization. They didn't want to be under Fannie Mae because Fannie Mae was, as they saw it, Fannie Mae was controlled by the commercial banks who were their competitors. So the savings and loan banks lobbied Congress and got a second agency set up, Federal Home Mortgage Loan Corporation, which becomes Freddie Mac. And these two organizations operated side by side. And you could argue that this was a good thing because it introduced some competition into the securitization market.
Yes, it sounds like Coke Pepsi.
Yeah, exactly like Coke Pepsi. Because, in fact, they didn't compete all that much. Two-company competition is better than one company, but it's still not a lot of competition. And both of these agencies were privatized in the late 1960s, early 1970s, but privatized in a funny way where the government, where people thought that the government was standing behind these companies and guaranteeing them in the event of a bankruptcy. And it turned out in August and September of 2008 that, in fact, the government did stand behind them because that's why the government bailed them out, and it's why we now own these companies again. Taxpayers own these companies.
Herman Schwartz here from the University of Virginia Department of Politics as we were teaching myself a little bit about economics and how we are to where we are today. He's the author of the book Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. We'll take calls a little bit more into the show, but first, a little conversation here with Professor Schwartz. The title of your book, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. You also, immediately into the book, you start using the phrase political economy. There's little reference to dollars and cents in that phrase. Political economy. Everyone is thinking about how much value their home has lost, the fact that they can't get a loan for dollars to purchase anything, the fact that their 401k or their stocks or et cetera has decreased in dollar value, political economy. I'd like you to explain that because it's a big part of the program as we continue forward. Political economy. I don't understand what that is.
Right. Political economy refers to the fact that We can think about the economy in a very abstract way, in which there are simply buyers and sellers. They understand exactly the same information. They engage in a once-only transaction and have no ongoing relationship in a market. And this is something like when you go into the store and you buy a loaf of bread. But most of the big, important financial markets don't work that way. So we talk about political economy to signal that these financial markets are highly structured. They're structured by the state, and they're not necessarily structured in ways that are efficient or rational or fair. And the reason that they're not efficient or rational or fair is that when you have the state involved, you've got politics, because states don't do things that are necessarily efficient, rational, and fair. They do things because of powerful groups that have interest in the outcome. So when you look at financial markets, what you see is there are no natural markets. All financial markets are structured by the state. There are regulations that allow people to do some things and not do other things. There are regulations about the kinds of financial instruments that can exist, things like stocks, CDs, bonds. All these things have to be permitted. Certain actors cannot buy certain things. So pension funds, for example, must invest in an investment-grade bond. And an investment-grade bond is also defined politically. The American tax code, the American government, says that to get an investment-grade rating, you have to go to a qualified rating agency, something like Standard & Poor's or Moody's. And this gives a lot of power to Standard & Poor and Moody's. So political economy refers to the idea that all of these markets are highly structured by the state, and there's a lot of power politics going on, a lot of fights over who's going to get what and who's going to benefit, who's going to lose.
And how has that changed since – actually, let me back up a second. I do want to know how that's changed since 2007, but I take it back to 2007 because in your book, Subprime Nation – you mentioned the 2007-2008 global financial crisis emerged from a chronic global imbalance of supply and demand. The average citizen, at least I consider myself one, thinks that the majority of this financial crisis started in 2008. If not in September or August when things started to go down, we go back to last March when Bear Stearns began its quick collapse. What happened in 2007 that you refer to it as that sort of being the start of the current problem?
Right. So we'll make a distinction here between underlying causes and proximate causes. Proximate means an immediate cause. So you can think about this with a person who has a heart attack. The underlying causes are 30 or 40 years of eating bacon and cheese burgers for breakfast every day and being sedentary, building up a whole lot of plaque in the arteries. The proximate cause is that running after the football at the Thanksgiving picnic, triggering the heart attack. And the heart attack in global financial markets started in 2007, not 2008. And the reason I say 2007 is that in 2007, housing prices had begun to get weaker, and you saw the first wave of defaults on what we now call subprime mortgages. And this caused a number of banks to fail, not so much in the U.S. as in other places. So in July of 2007, a medium-sized German bank, IKB, which had bought up a lot of mortgages backed by mortgage bonds backed by subprime mortgages, found that those mortgages were not paying interest anymore, and so their investments were worthless, and IKB goes bankrupt. Similarly, in Britain in the summer of 2007, one of the biggest lenders, Northern Rock, which had borrowed a lot of money to make mortgages and also had borrowed a lot of money to invest in subprime mortgage bonds, found that it no longer could borrow money. And so it, too, went bankrupt in the summer of 2007. And then finally in the U.S., Countrywide, not quite bankrupt, was in a lot of trouble. And Countrywide, for those of you who don't know, handles roughly 20% of all mortgages in the U.S., which means they handled the payments for those mortgages. And at that time it originated, it was issuing approximately 1 in 6, 16% of all U.S. mortgages. So in 2007, you already had the beginnings of trouble. You had big banks starting to go bankrupt. You had the political authorities arranging solutions to these problems. In the U.S., it's widely understood that the Federal Reserve Bank encouraged Bank of America to buy out Countrywide, thus saving that. And in Germany, the German Central Bank, the Bundesbank, arranged for a number of state banks to provide emergency lines of credit to IKB. And in Britain, the Treasury and the Bank of England similarly extended loans to Northern Rock and then eventually ended up nationalizing Northern Rock. So 2007 is really the start of the crisis in that that's when the big banks started to go bankrupt. And that's the little snowball at the top of the hill that creates the big avalanche of financial disaster in middle and late 2008 when global stock markets began selling off and when really, really large financial institutions like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and really, really large investment banks in the U.S. began to go bankrupt and get either nationalized or bailed out.
So that's the flashpoint?
Right. So 2007 is in some sense, the flashpoint. But one of the ways to really think about this is to look at things from the bottom up, because what it is that makes these mortgage bonds go bad, what it is that puts pain on the banks, is not stuff that happens so much at the top of the financial pyramid, but at the bottom. And a mortgage bond only has value to the extent that there's somebody there able to make their payments. And the real problem was that from late 2005, early 2006 onward, the people at the bottom of the pyramid who had taken out mortgages in 2005, 2006, found that they no longer could make their mortgage payments, and they started to default on those payments. And one way to think about this is that the person who caused the crisis is the last buyer of a house in Modesto, California, way overpriced, still nonetheless a lot cheaper than buying in Palo Alto or San Jose or San Francisco, who buys the house in Modesto, stretches their $60,000 a year income to buy a $400,000, $500,000 house, and then commutes 100 miles into the Silicon Valley in their SUV, and they're putting 50% of their income into the mortgage. And when gas prices start to rise in 2005, 2006, up towards $4 a gallon, they suddenly find out they don't have enough money. They have to make a choice. They can buy food, or they can buy gas to get to work, or they can make their mortgage payments. And what they realize is, if they don't eat, they're going to starve. If they don't go to work, they're not going to get a paycheck. So the thing they choose to stop making payments on is the mortgage. And as the mortgage payments from these subprime loans stop filtering up the financial food chain, then on the other end, the big financial institutions are not getting payments anymore, and they need those payments to survive because they basically have borrowed a lot of money in order to buy those mortgage bonds. And when they can't turn around and pay back the people that they've borrowed money from, then everybody starts to go bankrupt. So it's that last buyer in Modesto who did it all. I won't give you their name.
So right. So yeah. Once again, Modesto, California, continues
right.
Earning bad commentary.
Yeah.
University of Virginia professor Herman Schwartz here in the studio today as we talk about his book, Subprime Nation. And we're going to come back in just a moment and talk about American power, because I think that's something that will draw a lot of attention from listeners today. 11:19 here on the Wake Up Call. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly cloudy today, highs in the upper 60s here in Charlottesville as well as in the valley. Cloudy with showers after midnight tonight, lows 55 to 60. Scattered thunderstorms tomorrow, highs 60 to 65, just in the upper 50s in the valley. Right now, clouds across much of the listening area, 60 in the valley, 64 in Lynchburg, 62 in Richmond, 62 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And dial us up if you have a question for Professor Schwartz, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free number, WNRN Studio, if you want to send us a question on the instant message scene. Let me take a moment and congratulate Ellen Gilliam of Richmond and Abram Kaufman from Harrisonburg, the most recent grand prize winners from the Spring Fund Drive. Ellen will be picking up all the CDs she can in 91.9 seconds at Plan 9 Music. Abram will be taking home an Energy Take Classic 5.1 speaker system from Crutchfield. Pay your pledge by 5 p.m. Monday to be included in the next drawing for the two-night stay at the Hampton Inn and Suites here in Charlottesville, including dinner for two one night and the $500 shopping spree from Seaville Bike and Tri as another potential prize. And let me thank Alt Energy of Charlottesville for being with us today. Alt Energy providing professional design and installation of solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems can pay for themselves and reduce your carbon footprint. More can be found at AltEnergyIncorporated.com. I see the phone ringing right now, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. While I let Sean's here today to answer the phones and patch you through. Professor, just a quick background for yourself. How does Department of Politics end up talking about something that is so economic?
Oh, well, I'm kind of odd in the Department of Politics.
Because it seems like you'd be talking about the Obama regime or something else.
Right. That's because politics is more than just voting. Politics ultimately is about power. And that's why when you asked for the definition of political economy, I said we look at the economy in terms of who has power. So I'm in a Department of Politics because I think about this in terms of power rather than asking about how agents behave in idealized markets in which there are no regulations, are no struggles for power.
All right. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, since you asked about the global power part of this, that's part of the point. We could say we go back 30 years to the 1980s. Many of your listeners will remember that at the end of the 1980s, the U.S. economy looked very weak, and growth rates were below those in Japan and Germany. The U.S. dollar was falling by roughly 50% against the yen and the D-mark. There was a looming crisis in the savings and loan industry, and everybody was afraid that the Japanese were going to replace the U.S. as the number one economy, that the Japanese yen would replace the U.S. dollar. And all of those predictions turned out not to be true. Instead, in the 1990s, you had a reversal of all of those things. The German and Japanese economies suddenly slowed down. The American economy speeded up. And if we look at a few indicators of power in the global economy, we could say the American economy got much more powerful. For one thing, if we just look at the U.S. share of GDP, gross domestic product, output, among the rich countries, from 1991 to 2005, the U.S. share of rich country gross domestic product rose by 4.2 percentage points to hit 43%. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but in fact, it's a 10% increase in the U.S. share, and it reflected the fact that the U.S. economy was growing so much faster than Japanese or German economies. Similarly, if you look at control over world output, American companies' share of gross world output rose by 40% to be almost 8% in this time period. So the American economy revived very strongly, and the connection between and that revival gave the American state and the American economy more power in world markets. And the connection between that and housing is that it was housing that drove the U.S. economy, made the U.S. economy grow much faster than the German and the Japanese economies in the 1990s.
All right, here's a question that came in from a listener. What are the different types of global power?
Okay.
Because I can see that as being, okay, there's military power and there's dollar power and et cetera. And that's one of the questions that we're talking about, right, is how has the crisis affected America's power? Well, what kind of powers are there?
Right. So let's think about power in some big ways rather than in terms of tools. Let's think about the hands that hold the tools and the thinking behind the hands rather than the tools. And I would say there's three pieces to this. Piece number one is what I'll call an absence of constraint. And what that meant was that in the 1990s, the structure of American housing finance allowed the American economy to do three things that you usually can't do at the same time. The American economy overinvested at home, it overconsumed at home, and it overinvested overseas. Usually you face a trade-off on those three things. You can't spend more than you earn unless you borrow. The only way to spend more at home by both overinvesting and overconsuming and at the same time also invest overseas is to borrow a lot of money. So the American economy, American consumers, and the American state borrowed a lot of money in the 1990s. American foreign debt went from about $7 trillion to around $13 trillion. So we might say that American power was declining because debt was rising. But in fact, what this increase in debt showed was that the American economy faced no constraints. It could borrow very cheaply from overseas and then invest it in areas that yielded very high returns. So if you look at what the U.S. economy was borrowing, we were borrowing by selling foreigners treasury bonds, which yield a very low rate of interest. We were borrowing money by selling them mortgage-backed securities, which in the late 90s and certainly early 2000s yielded a very low rate of interest. And then we were turning around and investing that money in things that yielded very high rates of return. And this is the importance of the share of the share of world production that U.S. firms control, because that yields a much, much higher rate of return. Rather than paying only the 3 or 4% that mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds were paying, American investments overseas were earning 11%, 12%, 13%. So that was a huge signal of rising American power. Second thing that matters is control over production. And again, American firms' share of global output rises to almost 8%. And the American-owned share of foreign stock markets rises from 10 to 24%, while the foreign share of U.S. stock markets only rises from about 5 to 10%. So if I can put this a slightly different way, for every $2 of the American stock market that foreigners own, American companies, American investors own $5 of foreign stock markets. So there's more control over global output that way also. And then the last thing is this much faster rate of growth in the U.S. Than in the other rich countries. Although there's a lot of talk about India and China, for the foreseeable future, and certainly in the 1990s, the real competitors are other rich countries. Looking forward 10 years from now, 20 years from now, yes, India and China. But going back to 1990, the real competitors were Germany and Japan. And in the 1990s, the U.S., in fact, grew faster than these countries. And before we can start talking about military power, you have to have economic growth. You have to have economic power because military power costs money. So the significance of American growth being so much faster than that in Germany and Japan is that the U.S. economy, if it had to, could basically afford to fight these countries. Not that anybody plans to. And the same thing is true in relation between the U.S. And India or China. Faster U.S. growth means an economic capacity to fight a war later on. And here the significant fact is that despite very rapid economic growth in China or India in the 1990s and the O's, the U.S. share of the global economy was stable at around 20% over this entire 20-year period. And that's because we had such fast growth 1991 to 2005.
We are here talking with UVA professor Herman Schwartz about his new book, Subprime Nation. It's 11:29 here on the Wake Up Call. Let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for supporting WNRN. The staff at Blue Ridge do area runs and hikes themselves and can help you with anything you need to know and fit you with the footwear, gear, and performance clothing to fit your outdoor pursuits and lifestyle. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville. And they have two locations in Richmond and online at brms.com. Phone number 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. I have a question here, but I'm going to hold on for just a second because, wow, the phone things are building up. But we were talking about global power, and one of the things I want to know is, has our global power diminished or increased with this economic crisis? Because it seems like at least what we were led to believe was, oh, America, this is the start of the fall of the empire with what's happening. Oh, wait, everything is spread out to everybody else, maybe or maybe not. And I'm curious as to what the comparison is with the European countries and with our, you know, the up and rising India and China.
So here again is a difference between political economy and economics. Economists only care about what we call absolute growth, which is to say people getting better off. And that's absolute because 1% growth is great. And if someone else is having 2% growth, that doesn't matter because you're still getting 1% growth. But when we think about this in political terms or power politics or political economy, the issue is not absolute growth, but rather differential growth, the difference in growth rates, the relative difference. If you're worried about your political power, what you don't want to have happen is somebody catch up or grow faster than you. So in that sense, and that's a very perverse sense, if your economy is collapsing, that may not matter if everybody else's economy is collapsing even faster. So looking forward again, the crisis certainly is a catastrophe for the American economy and very problematic for American power, but it is not necessarily catastrophic for American power. And the reason is that Germany and Japan are having, in some ways, even worse crises. And they're having a worse crisis because their growth in the 1990s and the O's depended very heavily on exports, and in particular, exports to the U.S. In the 90s and the O's, they could not grow unless the U.S. economy grew. So what we see now is the American economy is not growing, and so the German and the Japanese economy are really slowing down. Japanese economy, the drop in GDP growth is larger than the U.S. The German economy, so far, it looks like the drop in GDP growth is about the same as the U.S., but it could easily get worse. And so relatively speaking, even though this is incredibly painful for the average American, American power remains relatively the same, and relatively is the important word. And the same thing is true for China and India. China had, on average, about 10% growth a year for the last 15 years. Pretty amazing. Pretty good for the average Chinese if they had a job and they weren't living in some next to some high-pollution factory. But the fundamental fact about China is that that 10% growth rate is needed to absorb all the people they have who otherwise wouldn't have jobs. China needs to grow at between 6 and 7% a year just to keep its head above water in terms of new entrants to the labor market. And Chinese growth now is below 7%. So there, too, the slowdown in American growth has led to a disproportionate slowdown in Chinese growth. And it's not clear that the Chinese will be able to get back to 10% growth a year without the stimulus that American demand for all those things China produces recovers.
All right, I got a variety of questions here. I keep giving out the phone number, and I'm not asking any questions. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Herman Schwartz from the UVA Department of Politics. His new book, Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble. Feel free to dial us up. All right, we're just going to go through these, Professor Schwartz. Jason from Stanton, what did the Bush administration do wrong, and what does the Obama administration have to do right to address the financial crisis?
Okay, easier to talk about Bush, partly because the mistakes are so obvious and also because it's history, so we know what happened. The basic problem in the financial market was that roughly $1.6 trillion was loaned to people buying houses in the U.S. who really had not much hope of paying that money back. They were borrowing that money in the hopes that they could count on rising home prices to bail them out of an expensive subprime mortgage and let them get enough equity in their house that they could then refinance into a lower interest prime or conforming mortgage. Conforming mortgages are what Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac buy. Those are the mortgages that most people hold, where you make a 10 or 20% down payment, you've got a good credit history, and your payments for housing are under 28% of your income. So what the Bush administration did was wink at the rise of a whole bunch of non-bank lenders, lenders making mortgage loans that were not regulated as banks because they were not taking deposits from the public in the form of savings and checking accounts. And these non-bank lenders are the ones who aggressively went out and made roughly, as I say, $1.6 trillion of loans to people with bad credit history, people buying houses that were way too expensive for them. And this includes not just people who were poor in buying a house, but also people with, you know, reasonable incomes, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, but who lusted after the granite kitchen counters and the stainless steel appliances and the 5,000-square-foot house, and thus ended up taking on a mortgage of $500,000, $600,000, and again, committing themselves to put 50% of their income into housing payments. And the crucial problem is that the Bush administration, or the crucial mistake the Bush administration made, was that they chose not to regulate these non-bank financial institutions making subprime loans. And they knew this was going to be a problem because in 2003, 2004, one of the members of the Federal Reserve Board, Ed Gramlich, came to the Fed and came to the Treasury Secretary and came to the OTC, which is the the OCC, which is the regulator for banks, and said, look, there's too much subprime lending being done. These people are not going to be able to make payments. There's going to be a lot of defaults. We have to do something about this. And the Bush administration had a meeting to decide what to do, and they decided we're not going to regulate these non-bank lenders. And the political reason for not regulating these non-bank lenders is very simple. At the bottom of the income period, bottom of the income pyramid are disproportionately Black and Latinos, and of course some poor whites. And the Bush administration and Karl Rove wanted to detach not all, but some of these voters from the Democratic political coalition. And they figured that these voters were culturally conservative. Okay. So if they could get these people into houses, they could also make them into economic conservatives, and then they would vote for the Republican Party.
All right. I guess we'll come back to part two of that in terms of the Obama administration. Phone calls and questions are building up. Caller from Stanton. Hey, caller.
Hey.
All right. Fire away. Your question or comment?
Just real quickly, I wondered what the professor thought of John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Yeah, interesting question. A little off topic. It's an interesting book. I'd like to see a lot more verification of the claims. It's certainly plausible. He argues that the U.S. government and U.S. financial institutions pushed loans onto third world countries and then triggered crises as a way of buying in to the financial systems of these countries. It is certainly true that the U.S. government had a very strong preference that these countries open up their financial markets. And it is certainly true that in the context of the 1994 Mexican peso crisis and the 1997 Asian financial crisis, that the U.S. administration used these crises to force open the financial markets in places like Korea. It is not clear that these crises were deliberately triggered by the American state. And one reason we might have to doubt that they were triggered is that these crises are very dangerous. As we've seen in the last couple of years, these crises can get extraordinarily large, can bring down important financial institutions, can create a whole lot of economic misery for people in the U.S., not just in those other places. So step one, step two, definitely he's on the right track in terms of whether these crises are deliberately triggered. I'd like to see a lot more evidence.
All right, caller, thanks.
Thank you.
979-0919, if you have a call or a question, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. We're here in the studio today on the Wake Up Call. Professor Herman Schwartz from the Department of Politics, his book, Subprime Nation. Let's do this.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Peter Vanderlinde's new machine turns trash into cash and saves the environment in the process. So why are local authorities suing Vanderlinde, and why did he hire spies? Did you hear about a Seville restaurant not allowing someone to enter because he was wearing a turban? Read more in The Hook. And get the story on Charlottesville possibly closing down the kids' swimming pool at McIntyre Park. The Hook, reminding you to take your medication. And let's thank 45fix.com. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, it's 45fix.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates, available anytime. That's the number 4 and the number 5 and the word fix.com. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because at noon, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. He refuses to play Elton John or Christopher Cross, but you will hear Foo Fighters, The Offspring, and Radiohead. Request always welcome. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, here on WNRN. All right, back in action with Professor Schwartz. I have a variety of questions here. So, Heather from Appomattox, don't give up. I have your question, but I want to ask this one, which sort of flashes back to something. Professor, anonymous caller, please clarify the Modesto scenario. You were talking about, you know, that one person who pushed us over the edge, sort of thing, if I understood that correctly. Doesn't the fault really lie with the bank for approving the loans that the homeowner could not afford?
That's correct. So I use the Modesto person as the example of the trigger, but I don't want you to think that this person in Modesto should get all the blame and that maybe we should take them out into the field and shoot them or something. There is definitely a lot of blame to be spread around, all the way from the bottom, which is people taking out loans that they really knew they couldn't afford. And then even more so, mortgage brokers making loans to people that they knew those people couldn't afford. The big banks, which were the ones who funded these mortgage brokers, were quite willing to accept these loans and package them up to be sold on as mortgage-backed securities. And there, too, they knew that these loans probably were not going to be repaid or that there would be serious defaults. But they were quite happy to extend the credit and then sell the bonds on to the investment banks because they knew there would be no comeback. They knew that after 90 days or 180 days, these things would be off their books and they wouldn't be out of pocket. They wouldn't lose money if the mortgages couldn't be paid. The investment banks also engaged in an enormous amount of shenanigans and in the way they structured their own investments with these bonds. And the credit rating agencies deserve a lot of blame for putting a AAA credit rating on bonds and CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, built on these mortgage-backed securities. So there's definitely plenty of blame in the food chain. In fact, all the way through the entire food chain, there was a widespread belief in two things that were not true. The first thing was that none of this would ever come back to bite somebody in the butt because they would have passed the risky debt on to someone else, and that even if it did come back to bite them in the butt, it wouldn't happen for a long time because housing prices were going to keep on rising forever and ever. So those two forms of crazy belief underlay a lot of what was going on, along with a lot of greed. So yes, the person in Modesto shares only a small part of the blame here, and the financial sector certainly has a lot of the blame.
And I guess that sort of runs into this next question from another anonymous caller. Because the last question was about, isn't it the fault of the homeowner or the person trying to buy the home? Well, it's a home. You have to live somewhere, and in certain parts of the country, much like California, you can't live 3 hours from your job, and you have to have a job. It's not your fault that where the commercial industry is built compared to the residential industry. So this question is, what about the home builders making two or three times the actual worth of the house, and how and when did houses go from being a house home to an investment?
Let's start with the second question first. Back in the day, people's houses were homes, and they were also, in some ways, a very safe kind of investment. So if you think about people's life cycle, they buy houses when they're young, and then and they have income, and they pay for the house. So you buy a house when you're 25, 30, 35. You make 30 years of mortgage payments, and then you're 55, 60, 65. You retire, and, of course, when you retire, your income drops precipitously because you're not working. So security in retirement in America used to rest on a three-legged stool. Leg one was Social Security, which gave you a guaranteed minimum income, was insurance against poverty. Leg two was any kind of private pension you might have from your company or by savings in an IRA or 401k. And leg three was the house, and the house was part of the pension because if you owned your house free and clear at age 65, you didn't have to make payments for housing when you were in retirement. So your income needs went down at the same time that your income went down. And in the 90s, and even more so in the O's, people's attitudes about their houses started to change, and they started to change because falling interest rates made house prices rise, and because house prices continued to rise quite substantially, people began to believe that it didn't matter if their house wasn't paid off. They began to say, I can tap some of the equity in my house and spend it on a car, spend it on remodeling, spend it on a vacation. And so they started treating houses like investments. And their attitude was, well, even if I still owe money on the house at age 65, I can flip this house, I can sell it, take out all my accumulated equity, and buy a smaller house. So there definitely was a change in attitude. And that change in attitude was abetted by the financial industry, which created home equity lines of credit and home equity loans, which enabled people to actually tap into the equity. People didn't used to be able to do that. So that's a big change, and that's problematic. As for what was going on with homeowner psychology and the relationship between that and builders, it's a little bit hard to say. That's not my area of expertise. But it does seem clear to me that there was a kind of a craziness where people started to say that Formica wasn't good enough anymore and 3,000 square feet wasn't good enough anymore, and that they really needed to have the granite countertop and the 5,000 square foot mini mansion. And builders aren't crazy people. If that's what the market was demanding, they were quite happy to build those things and, yes, make big profits doing so. So if people had not been able to get loans, then the builders would have built different kinds of housing because that's what the market would have sustained. So there I would put less blame on the builders and more blame on the financial industry, which was willing to extend credit to people so they could buy these larger houses.
All right, Herman Schwartz here in the studio today. We're talking about subprime nation and economics situation here in the, I guess it's a global conversation, 979-0919, if you would like to ask your question or make your comment. I want to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to put this show together today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. Professor, we got a call a little earlier from Heather in Appomattox. Her question, how important is it to our economy to shift things to green, renewable energy? Is that up your alley?
Yeah, I can say a little bit about that. There's two different ways in which it's important. One way, if we think about it in terms of American power, is that anything that reduces dependence on foreign oil is definitely a big plus factor. So at the level of power, defunding oil producers, many of whom are countries that are hostile to the U.S., Iran, Venezuela, Russia, is a good idea. In terms of the average American, who cares probably a little bit less for American power and a little bit more for their own economic security, shifting to green technology is probably a good thing. And the reason is that, again, at the bottom of all of this, the problem is that people just don't have enough income to make payments on their mortgages. So we need to find some way to put people back to work. And by putting them back to work and giving them income, they'll be able to make payments on their mortgages. And by making payments on their mortgages, they will restore some value to the mortgage-backed securities that are at the root of the crisis here. So if green technology, understood broadly, puts more people back to work, that's definitely a big plus factor in getting the economy back on track.
University Professor Herman Schwartz here, Department of Politics, and author of Subprime Nation. 11:50 on the Wake Up Call. Still plenty of time for your call or comment. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Professor, a question from a caller. Does America have a history of subprime loans? And if so, what were the outcomes before?
Yes, America does have a history of subprime loans. There have always been people whose income was erratic. Think about self-employed people or contractors. There have always been people who have gotten themselves into bankruptcy for some reason and then came back to the market to buy a house. And the banking industry has always catered to those people. The difference between situation and what we have now is volume and due diligence. So banks always made subprime loans back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, but they were a very small number of loans. Each loan was examined individually by a bank official to make sure that the person actually could document some of their income, even if it was erratic. And the banks, and this is really the critical point, the banks looked very carefully at those loans because they were going to hold those loans on their books. And if the mortgager defaulted, it was the bank that was going to feel the pain. The change occurs in the O's when we enter this era of Bush deregulation, and banks start saying, we can make a lot of subprime loans, and we can package them up and sell them off to somebody else, so they won't be on our books. And so the banks stopped looking at every individual subprime borrower, and they subcontracted out the origination of loans to mortgage brokers who had no incentive to look very carefully. So the number and volume of subprime loans rose dramatically. It went from being less than $100 billion a year to being, as I say, a cumulative 1.6 or 1.8, depending on which years you use, trillion dollars of loans. And the banks were unconcerned about this because they were selling them on to somebody else. So, yes, we've always had subprime loans, but the big difference is that the banks were on the hook for them before, and so they were a lot more careful about who they loaned to, and they loaned to people who were much, much more likely not to default on those loans. Right now, the default rate on subprime mortgages originated in 2005, 2006, 2007 is running at around 40 and 50%, depending on which year you look at.
And before?
Before, probably less than 10%. Mm. Big difference.
Here's a call, a question from Charlie in Troy, Virginia. Why have there not been more prosecutions of those who got us in this mess?
Well, that's a good question. I'd like to know the answer to
Charlie's
that question,
kinda cool.
Too. Yeah, I'd like to know the answer to that question, too. It's probably got a lot to do with the fact that these are the people who make a lot of contributions to the people who run this country, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. The financial services industry was generating capturing 40% of all corporate profits in the U.S. in the last decade. And if you capture 40% of all profits, you've got a lot of money to do a lot of lobbying. You've got a lot of money to make a lot of campaign contributions. You've got a lot of money to take Congress people off to vacations to do golfing in Scotland. And the financial services industry was very careful to do this because they knew that the structure of their business is created by the government. They could not be in business if the government did not structure and regulate their business.
All right, Professor. We talked earlier about the power that goes along with, the rise and fall of the economic situation. And we've mentioned several times about how, at least media-wise, China and India are the up-and-coming players and how, they're suffering the least, although you mentioned earlier about their the increase in their situation, the increase in their, GDP?
GDP, gross domestic product.
And how that needs to stay high for them to actually be increasing in their power. But one of my questions, how are China and India actually increasing in power if the valuable items, they were air quotes there, the valuable items that they hold are decreasing in dollar value here in America? I mean, and I said this earlier, if I have stocks or my home or the things that I hold that are of value are decreasing in dollar value, then I'm a less dollar valuable person. How is that working for those two countries?
Right. Okay, so there's an old joke in the finance industry, which is that if you owe the bank $10,000 and you can't pay them back, you have a problem. But if you owe the bank $100 million and you can't pay them back, the bank has a problem. So when you look at the Chinese, they're the bank here. They hold about $2 trillion of assets, of which about $1.7 trillion is dollar-denominated assets. Most of that is public debt, American public debt, treasury debt, and different forms of mortgage debt. Okay, so if this money can't be paid back, well, in some ways it's the Chinese who have a problem. So that's one way of saying, well, they've got we owe them a lot of money, but it doesn't really make much difference. They can't use that money to do anything to hurt us. On the other side of the equation, we could ask, why were they quite happy to accumulate this debt? Why did they buy American treasury bonds? And the answer is they did get something that was real and that did help them. If you look at China in 1990, it was an extremely poor country. No highways, no subways, no airports, no factories, very backward technology, terrible universities. Look at China today. It's not a rich country by any means, but it has a lot of factories. It has the ability to make cars in large numbers. It has the ability to make semiconductors, computer chips in large numbers. It has the ability to make consumer durables in large numbers. It has subway systems, air traffic control systems, airports. It's starting to assemble aircraft. So there's been a huge change in China's industrial capacity. And the connection between that and the debt is that the Chinese could sell stuff to the U.S. that was based on low-wage labor with little skills. If you go into Bed Bath & Beyond, Walmart, Target, everything there is made in China. All that stuff is, I won't say junk because they'll probably sue me. Let's just say the quality is highly questionable. But people in America were happy to buy those things because the price was right. $3 T-shirt, $3 turtleneck from Target, sure. Bathroom set from Bed Bath & Beyond for $20, sure. And so the Chinese were able to sell this stuff to the U.S. And instead of taking the dollars they got and going back to the U.S. and buying cars, buying aircraft, buying pharmaceuticals, instead they bought treasury bonds and they built up their own industries. So they made the best of a bad bargain, or they made the best of their situation by building up industrial capacity by exporting to the U.S. rather than exporting to the U.S. and then going back and importing from the U.S. So the glass is half empty for the Chinese. They have a lot of questionable American debt right now, but they also have a lot of factories they didn't used to have.
All right, just the last few seconds here with Professor Schwartz from the Department of Politics. Professor, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Subprime Nation, American Power, Global Capital, and the Housing Bubble, Professor Herman Schwartz, UVA Department of Politics. You can find that book around town where?
You can find that book on Amazon in August. Unfortunately, August of 2009. So wait a couple months. You can get it on Amazon. You could probably get it at the UVA bookstore. maybe in some of the other fine bookstores in town. Who knows?
Thank you so much for being a guest today. Let me thank
you,
also everyone who donated their time and money last week to the Wake Up Call. It's much appreciated. I can't say that often enough. And a big thanks today to Sean McCord, who helped me put this program together. So thanks to Sean. Next week, we will be talking about the infamous Meadow Creek Parkway here on the Wake Up Call. Thanks again. Drew Thompson up next. Les Temps Perdue.
This has been your Sunday morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.